you all for coming to have this conversation. I really appreciate you making time.
Thank you all. Yes, thank you. Let me thank you as well for coming. And welcome to the launch of America Versus the West. I don't actually need to hold it up, do I? It's right behind me. By Dr. Corey Sharkey, the ninth book in the Lowy Institute's collaboration with Penguin Random House Australia. The Lowy Institute Papers is our flagship series at the Lowy Institute, published twice a year, and we're delighted to collaborate with Corey on this volume. My name's Sam Roggeveen. I'm director of the International Security Program at the Lowy Institute. I'm also editor of the Lowy Institute Papers series, and I'm proud to say I edited the book that we are launching this evening.
And he is a rigorous and uncompromising editor, I can assure you.
So on that subject, actually, it might interest you to know that even though Corey and I have been in touch for, I guess, over a year now over this book, we hadn't actually met until about half an hour ago. And look, Corey strikes me on early acquaintance as being, you know, one of the most sunny and agreeable people you would ever hope to meet. But given that I was her editor, no doubt I annoyed her in a thousand different ways over the course of this project. So if the conversation this evening gets a little barbed, that's my fault, not hers. So a few formalities. First of all, let me just tell you a little bit about Corey. Dr. Corey Sharkey is Deputy Director General of the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. She's held policy positions across government, in academia and think tanks, including working with both the military and civilian staffs of the Pentagon, in the White House, at the National Security Council, and at the US State Department as Deputy Head of Policy Planning. She was an advisor to Senator John McCain in his 2008 presidential campaign.
I describe it as sailing on the pirate ship McCain in 2008.
We're going to get into that, actually. Yeah, let's talk about that. She's authored a number of books, including Safe Passage, an account of the transition from UK to US power on the global stage, published in 2017. And most recently, of course, she was the author of America Versus the West, a Lowy Institute paper, which we proudly published with Penguin. So would you please put your hands together for Corey Sharkey? So let's begin, and just to quickly set the scene for this conversation, I want to point out that we're gathered here in Canberra at a time when the term rules-based order, or one of its variations, has never, I would argue, been more prominent in our national conversation about foreign policy. It peppers the speeches of our prime ministers, our foreign ministers, our opposition leaders. The erosion of the US-led rules-based order was a prominent feature of the 2017 Foreign Policy White Paper. And the Defence White Paper from 2016 says a rules-based global order is a fundamental strategic interest for Australia. So, although some of the ideas we're going to discuss this evening sound perhaps a little abstract or conceptual, it clearly matters a lot to the practical daily realities of Australian foreign policy. In fact, I think it's one of the strongest features of Corey's book. She stresses that the post-World War II rules-based order wasn't built by starry-eyed idealists or dreamers, but by people who had fought the greatest and the bloodiest war in history. For them, the creation of this order wasn't an exercise in liberal utopianism. It was, in fact, founded in a profound sense of tragedy, a realisation of what humankind is capable of when our behaviour isn't bounded by rules. So I'm going to begin the conversation tonight with Corey, but I plan to leave plenty of time for your questions. My experience moderating evenings like this, Corey, is that inevitably when I call for questions, a lot of male hands go up. So I'm going to be looking for female hands.
I'm banking on you.
And I'm going to try to get an even split. So Corey, with your permission, if you're ready to go, let's begin. And I'd like to start with what's behind us here, this image. This fabulous, incredible photo that really is already, I think, one of the iconic images of the Trump presidency. And I should mention, actually, that it was your idea to put this image on the book. We'd never before put a photo on the cover of one of our Lowy Institute papers. This is the first. It was your idea. It was a fabulous idea. Tell us what's going on in that paper. And I mean that both literally and figuratively. So begin just with literally, where was it taken and what was going on? But then also tell us a bit about why you chose it and what's the metaphor in the image?
Sure, yeah, gladly. So it's a picture taken from the G7 meeting in Ottawa, was it, in Canada? The one where President Trump left early and refused to sign the communique. And after he was on the airplane, had a whole bunch of nasty things to say about the Canadian Prime Minister, who was the host. And what I love about the picture, it feels like a Renaissance portrait to me. The most interesting thing about the picture, though, is that it's the German Chancellor's office that released it, right? If you look at it, right, so the long-serving German Chancellor, whose strategy for dealing with a disruptive American president who's sort of erratic and reckless with the rules-based order, she's stolid, right? Germanic. She's leaning forward assertively on the table and stressing her point to him. And you see a truculent American president, and behind him, the mustachioed, truculent counselor holding his papers, right? John Bolton, the national security advisor. And you see the Japanese prime minister sort of kind of mimicking the American president's pose, but not really separating himself from the others. You see Mr. Juncker, the head of the European Commission, putting his hands on the table. No, that's Macron's hands on the table. So Macron is mimicking Angela Merkel, but standing up a little straighter and looking better for the picture. And the European Union Commission head is kind of looking at his shoes, but taking credit for what's going on here. I actually thought it captured this moment among the liberal powers in the international order really nicely. And one of the things I do in the book is try and tease out the different strategies that the different liberal leaders have taken at a time where the United States, far from being in its traditional pose as the rule setter and enforcer of the international order, what Donald Tusk, the head of the European Council, describes as, you know, such a surprise that the challenger of the rules-based liberal order is its architect, the United States of America. So I loved the way that captured it, and I loved it that Merkel's office released that, because just as President Trump is playing domestic politics with the international order, so is the German Chancellor. And I was in Munich for their big security conference a couple of weeks ago, and there were bookend speeches. The first one by the Vice President of the United States, Mr. Pence, that was not particularly well received, right? Kind of strident, announcing that American leadership is back, and kind of forgetting that to be a leader, you have to actually have people willing to follow you. But also the German Chancellor getting a rousing round of applause for criticizing American policy, but then scolding everybody that you need to be multilateralists while Germany is refusing to make a multilateral compromise on the Nord Stream 2 project. And also explaining that, you know, we all need to make compromises, we can't be nationalists. Just as Germany backed out of the European Union's arms sale to Saudi Arabia or some other country. So we're all virtue signaling and not actually listening very much to each other. That's what the picture says to me.
And you're quite critical of Germany, of Merkel's Germany in the book, right, about its unwillingness to really step forward despite the reassuring language.
Yeah, so I object to it for two reasons. The first is that it's flat-out bad strategy because Germany still lives in a pretty dangerous neighborhood, and they're being reckless because they bought strategic depth with Poland's admission to NATO. But the United States raised its defense spending by $45 billion last year. That is the entirety of the German defense budget. So the 5% that we raised our defense spending is the entirety of the German defense budget. And the problem with Angela Merkel's strategy, which is to condescend from the commanding heights of Germany's moral virtue, is that, first of all, it can't deliver the United States, and her country's security counts on delivering the United States. And second of all, it too isn't leadership, right? Because if you are going to write off the American underwriting of your security, and fair enough that Germany would want to do it, one of the things Colin Powell taught me when I was working for him in the joint staff was, you never beat a bad idea with no idea. And so what's the solution to cajoling Donald Trump into more cooperative behavior? And Germany doesn't have an answer to that.
Right. One more question about the photo. You've got John Bolton, as it were, standing at the right hand of the father. But in a sense, they represent, they're not a unity ticket on this liberal order question at all, are they? They represent two very different perspectives on that question, neither of them particularly...
constructive?
Yes, friendly, I was going to say, towards the kind of ideal that you talk about in the book. So can you say a little bit about what's going on inside the White House? And it's been said, for instance, that there are at least two foreign policies coming from the Trump White House, one from Trump himself another from the rest of his team.
So one of the interesting strategies that liberal countries, a couple of liberal countries have tried to take, everybody is turning keys in the lock, trying to figure out, how do I deliver American power to preserve the liberal order at a time in which the United States doesn't seem particularly cautious or interested in doing so? Sweden and Finland have had one of the most interesting strategies, which is to ignore the White House and try and do quiet, important, binding work with the Department of Defense. So when Jim Mattis was still the defense secretary, he signed a trilateral agreement between Sweden, Finland, and the United States to do routine military exercises, to basically pull them as close to NATO as you can be without being a member of the organization. And it's an interesting strategy, I admire it, but again, the problem with their strategy is the risk of presidential abandonment in your hour of need. And that's the problem with everybody in the administration having a different strategy, because at the end of the day, the president's vote is the one that matters. So my institute, the IISS, runs a meeting of defense ministers in Singapore every year. And 2 years ago, Jim came and talked and gave a speech that would have been utterly unexceptional in any American administration of the last 70 years, except the one he was serving in. Mm-hmm. And it was, the importance of alliances, that trade undergirds our political commitment to each other, that mutual prosperity is a big part of what all of our governments are engaged in, and that creates deep and binding friendships. The first question he got asked by Michael Fulilov, the head of the Lowy Institute, was, how can we believe you given the president's behavior? And this last year, when Jim gave a barn burner of a, debt trap diplomacy and we all need to band together on China, people's reaction was, we wish we could believe you, but we actually have to look after our own security. Mm-hmm. And that's not an answer an American administration has gotten in a really long time. So I do think that gives a sense of the corrosion of the order without the United States actively encouraging everybody else to underwrite it. Because the thing that Bolton and Trump have in common is that they both have a fundamentally mistaken view about the dynamic of alliance relationships. What both of them believe is that if the United States steps back, allies will be forced to step forward, right? Their own self-interest will drive them towards doing the same things the United States would have done, and saving us the trouble. And that's just historically inaccurate. What happens is when the United States steps back, allies step back even further, and the people who step forward are our adversaries. And so the order becomes more brittle, margins for error narrow, and you are likelier to get big conflagrations that way.
So you touched on China in that answer, and that's something I'd love to get back to as we were discussing earlier. It's a major preoccupation in this town, as you can imagine.
Well, it should be.
But I feel like in the best social science tradition, before we get any further, we should define our terms. So I'm going to trouble you just with a short definition of this phrase that we hear so often, the liberal international order. In the book, you have three elements to the liberal international order: the rules-based order, the security order, and the liberal order. Can you briefly take us through it?
Sure, gladly. So when I wrote the book, that's John Eikenberry's formulation. He's the foremost scholar of liberalism as an international relations theory. Mm. And what he argues is that the rules-based order comes first, right? So there's this mythology that the rules-based order was like dreamed up by liberal college professors in the faculty lounge to try and shackle American power to everybody else's interests. And fun as that kind of historical revisionism is, it's wrong in all sorts of ways. The way to think about the liberal order is that it was grudgingly constructed by the United States, trying to do the absolute minimum that it could to commit to creating an international order that wasn't going to twice in people's lifespans produce wars like World War I and World War II. So they started by believing that we could just create institutions, right? This is the legacy of Woodrow Wilson and the League of Nations, a belief that if you create an institution where everybody agrees on the rules that bind us all, that, you know, glitter, unicorns, international peace. And of course, that proves unwieldy very quickly. And so but what the rules-based order gets exactly right is that the reason that the time of American dominance in the international order has seen far fewer challenges and almost no hedging against it by other strong powers, right? That's historically anomalous that would happen. The reason is because we actually legitimate our power in the eyes of others by creating rules and embedding those rules in institutions where it feels like strong powers and weak powers get treated the same. So just to use the NATO example, anybody know how large the military forces of Luxembourg are? Take a guess. 1,500 soldiers, right? The lieutenant colonel who commands the Luxembourg military gets the same weight and votes in NATO as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In theory, right? In reality, if Poland needs defending, what the US thinks is gonna care a little more. But the brilliance of the liberal international order is establishing rules that everybody agrees to and voluntarily complies with. So you get more burden sharing because people do it voluntarily. They do it because of the basic bargain that we are all bound by the same, we all have the same objective and are bound by the same rules. So the fun of folks who like to call themselves realists, right? These are the people who are hard-nosed about power being what dictates states' behavior in the international order, which, by the way, is wrong. And they are the beneficiaries of the best selection of a title of anybody ever, right? Because by definition, they're realistic. And everybody else is unrealistic. But what they actually are is cynical. The belief that ideas don't matter, that values don't matter, that only sheer material power is the driver of the international order. But of course, that's not true, right? The magnetism of our ideals drives down the cost of what we're trying to do in the world. And the rules-based order is a big part of that. The second piece of it comes with security guarantees, because, of course, you couldn't get the system working without security guarantees. And so the United States made deals that we would help countries that we cared about, either because they shared our values or we had common interests. The third piece of it is the liberal part of the liberal order. And it comes last and becomes increasingly important for two reasons. The first is because the nature of states that are representatively governed, that is, where you have the luxury of throwing your government out of power, which Australia does every, 4 to 6 months, I'm told. the Nobel Prize winning Iranian lawyer, Shirin Ebadi, describes it, I think, best. She says, states that are responsible to their publics, they just have different interests. So the United States has believed since 1945 that countries that share our values make the international order safer. And political scientists like to argue about it all of the time, right? Is there a democratic peace? Can anybody name me a war between democratic powers? Because there's only one. The Cod War. Do you have it? Ha ha ha! Okay, you have stumbled into a subject I actually know something about. No, because at the time Britain and America fought in 1776 and in 1812, Britain was not really a democracy. That you don't have a real franchise in Britain until about 1853.
Well, by that definition, America wasn't quite a democracy either.
Yes, excellent point. I take it on board. So the example, though, is the Cod War between Britain and Iceland in 1973, about 4 shots fired over fishing rights. But that we have to, yeah.
Coming back to your point, Britain wasn't a democracy until the 1850s. What about the Reform Bill of 1832?
You've started something, Corey.
Okay, you have warmed my nerdy heart. Thank you so much. So let's see. I cannot now dredge up the actual numbers, but I did the research when I was writing my book about the hegemonic transition between Britain and the United States. And you still, before 1860, you still don't even have 50% of the British public voting.
Okay. I want to open it up
Thank
to all of you.
Thank you for going down that rabbit hole. Yeah. It warms my heart.
I want to open it up to you in a minute, but I really want to ask my China question.
Yeah.
I referred earlier to Australia's foreign policy white paper, which was published in 2017. That document forecasts that by 2030, the Chinese economy will be worth $42 trillion, whereas the US economy at that point will be worth $24 trillion. So we could say maybe by 2035, roughly, that the Chinese economy will be double the size of the US economy. In an environment like that, where China, as an authoritarian power, is already much bigger than the Soviet Union has ever been, and given the kind of challenge that China represents to the liberal international order that you defend, how does that order thrive? In fact, how is it even sustained against a challenge like that?
So two things. The first is I think those projections are nonsense. And one of my very favorite, I commend to all of you going back and reading the CIA's projections of the Soviet economy in the 1950s. Because one of the difficulties about economic projections is that they tend to be a straight line and taking growth rates now and, oh my God, if the Chinese economy grows at 10 or 12% a year, they become the huge, and neither math works that way, nor does international relations work that way, right? So a couple of things. The first is there is no economy that has grown sustainably prosperous without becoming politically liberal, right? This is Hegel's argument that as people grow more prosperous, they grow more, they become more demanding political consumers. And so that argument suggests that, so anybody know what China's per capita GDP is right now? It's about $8,800. So roughly Kazakhstan, Mexico, Russia, Equatorial Guinea, right? Over a billion people, that's non-trivial. But the challenges of getting from having a per capita GDP of $8,800 a person to $46,000 a person are non-trivial. Navigating the middle income trap is actually really hard, and most states don't do it. And no state has done it that hasn't grown politically representative. And if you think about the nature of where our economies are headed, so the Chinese are headed into the Lewis trap, which is they have now just about maxed out the rural to urban translation that drove the industrial revolution of almost every developed country. They are challenged in thinking about how do you get to the kind of creative economy, the one I was talking to a couple of folks outside in the hall, where the kind of economy where my idiot nephews can earn their keep by dreaming up names that beer should be called, copywriting those names and selling them, right? That is where our economies are headed. All of us learning how to pull rabbits out of our hats is the future we are headed to. That is fundamentally inconsistent with a repressive society. So maybe the Chinese can pull it off, but nobody has pulled it off. And so to suggest that there's a direct and linear relationship between continued economic growth that doesn't have to think about what do you do when you move up the manufacturing chain? How do you create the kind of vibrancy that you see in the Australian economy and the American economy in a society that fundamentally does not trust individual initiative? And an economy that fundamentally depends on all of our economies for its prosperity. So the challenge, the Soviet Union could remain autarkic, or at least within the Warsaw Pact. China at least has not demonstrated that it can. All I'm saying is there are a lot of challenges that China has to get past. And for those of you who think the Chinese are brilliant strategists with a 100-year timeline, you need to answer the question of why do they activate the antibodies against their continued rise when GDP per capita is $8,800? Why not wait until you've won the artificial intelligence race? Why not wait until American universities aren't kicking you out of their networks? Why not wait until Huawei already dominates the 5G spectrum in all of our infrastructure?
Yeah. Let me open it up now, and I'll ask you to just put your hand up and wait for the microphone. We prefer questions rather than short speeches or statements. So the polite stuff's over now, Corey. So this is where we get
to the real thing. Good. I came here for a brawl.
Hi, Corey. I'm Nathan. Taiwan is perhaps the greatest ideological threat for China, in that it is a Chinese cultural community that overcame its own dictatorship under the nationalists and became a vibrant democracy. Considering the economic realities of China being such a major economic power that all countries to some degree rely on, what can liberal powers do to realistically preserve the viability of a Taiwanese independent entity?
I love that question. So the last time I was in Taiwan, I was struck by the number of Taiwanese government officials who, when I asked them to give me a sense of how worried they were about Chinese influence in Taiwanese society, their answer was, unification will come when China is like Taiwan. And what they believed they were seeing was an enormous number of Chinese tourists who come to Taiwan and watch political talk shows, right? And that made the Taiwanese, in my judgment, perhaps unrealistically confident that they could be a virus that spreads through Chinese society. Because, of course, the dirty little secret of authoritarian societies is that once you have repression in place, it's actually not that hard to sustain it in place. And the Chinese are successfully doing that. But my own sense is that Taiwan's vibrancy is its own reward, and they have done an extraordinarily good job of navigating a very weak position extraordinarily well. And as somebody who looks at strategy, I wish my country was nearly as adroit and careful about its decisions as Taiwan has been, because I think they've threaded the needle very adroitly. So what can all of us do to help them? First of all, we can commit to defend their independence. That's a good thing to do, not least because it may deter China from making reckless choices. And second of all, because they deserve us defending them. The other things we could do, we could admit them to international institutions. We could include them in international gatherings to give them legitimacy that my country withdrew from them in 1973. And other countries fear because of not just China's economic power, but the way China is wielding its economic power to do that. But parenthetically, China is behaving the way the United States behaved in Latin America in the 1890s, and we are still dealing with the long shadow of that legacy. And so China's strategy has its natural limits, right? As I was trying to argue, the genius of American strategy after 1945 is that most people want us to succeed and don't work against us. The problem with China's strategy is that even recipients of Belt and Road Initiative loans and infrastructure begin to be worried about Chinese influence. And that's going to make much more costly the establishment of a powerful position in the international order, and it's going to make it much more brittle even if they achieve it.
Who do we have next?
So you said that the liberal world order has sort of painstakingly been crafted over the last 70 years. Do you think it's strong enough to withstand a 4 or 8 year long term of a Trump government, given how corrosive the last 3 years have been? Or do you think that actually the rule-based or liberal world order isn't as strong as we would hope it would be?
That's a fantastic question. So I met at the reception beforehand some deep state radio nerds, and they will know what all of you should know, which is that I am the lifetime holder of the tiara of optimism. So I am inclined to believe that the liberal order is, that we are underestimating its sturdiness and its resilience.
You should just briefly say what Deep State Radio is, by the way.
So it's a podcast that David Sanger from the New York Times, David Rothkopf, Rosa Brooks, a law professor at Georgetown, and Ed Luce, the U.S. columnist for the Financial Times, and I do a couple of times a week, where we talk about American politics and American foreign policy. And the running joke between us is that Rosa, who's always expecting the apocalypse, wears the thorny crown of entropy, and I have the tiara of optimism, because I always think there's going to be a way out. We're going to find a way to do this. And I'm actually quite heartened by the resilience of the liberal order. I take your point that one Trump term is different from two Trump terms for a couple of reasons. First, he's burning like a wildfire through the goodwill that 70 years of the U.S. Building and sustaining the liberal order has achieved. But second, because, you know, American politics, our American political culture, and the structure of the American political system is more risk tolerant than almost any other free society. And I realize how crazy that sounds talking to Australians who live in the most dangerous place in the world. But American politics, because we are tied so tightly to our electorate, elections every 2 years, a permanent political campaign, right? A parliamentary system has more buffers in it than the American system does. So we tend to have wider swings one direction and another than most other free societies endure. And we're culturally more tolerant of that. So one of the risks of being an American ally is that any idiot can run for president in the United States and very often gets elected. And the difference between doing it once, though, and re-electing President Trump, once you see what it's going to be like, you know, the daily enervation of it. I myself am thirsting for barring competence in my government. I would like it, politics not to be the central focus of our national conversation in the same light. And allies will react differently if we re-elect President Trump. But what I think I see in the international order, and what I talk a lot about in the book, is the middle powers stepping forward to sustain the order, even if the United States isn't. And it's actually really delightful to see. Roy Metcalf was the one who first saw the pattern. So Japan, Australia, and South Korea bringing the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership into being even when the United States steps back. The very shrewd choices the Japanese government is making to strengthen the coast guards of Vietnam and the Philippines, the cooperation between the French and Australian navies as major naval powers to sustain the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, and even going beyond. So I think the states that have the most to lose if the liberal order does collapse are actually taking very assertive state choices to try and sustain it. But the other thing is, I actually think the liberal order really is genuinely resilient. And if I were the Chinese National Security Advisor, I would be worried about two things. One, that we have left the free societies time to adapt. And free societies aren't good at having it right. We're good at getting it right, because we have big, loud arguments and we think our way through to pretty robust solutions as a general rule. So I would be worried about leaving time. The second thing I would be worried about if I were the Chinese National Security Advisor is that mom whose son didn't get to go to college because, you know, she got drunk and made a fool of herself on a cruise ship and her social credit score got dinged, she's an insider threat. And that's a much bigger problem for authoritarian societies than it is for free societies, even as much as we worry about it. The last thing I'll say about this is that free societies are increasingly, actually not just free societies, authoritarian societies too are playing internal to free societies. And right now we're having the shock of realizing the vulnerability of our adversaries playing in our domestic politics. But we haven't yet got ourselves to the point to put topspin on the ball and realize that the tools of free societies are an enormous threat to authoritarian societies. Let me just give you my favorite example of it. The expense of my tax dollars I am happiest about in the last 15 years was the Obama administration's ambassador to Beijing started posting the air quality index in Beijing, right? Costs virtually nothing, forces accountability on the Chinese government with its own public. That's what free societies can do, because we live in a world where our governments are accountable. Authoritarian societies don't. So rocking them back on their heels by finding ways to make them accountable to their own publics is a largely untapped source of strength that we have, and that Australia begins to model for all of the rest of us ways to use the levers of free society, to use law, to use regulation, to use the vibrancy of your own society to inoculate itself.
So I think what you're saying is that there's nothing so broken about American politics that can't be fixed by an election. Is that right?
Yeah, it is true that that what is wrong with American politics is also what is right with American politics, right? Like the craziness of no gatekeepers, and President Trump crested the wave right at the right time. And is genuinely brilliant at asking first order questions.
Yes.
But what I think you already begin to see, and the 2018 elections were one demonstration of it. So on inhospitable territory for Democrats, they picked up the House of Representatives and very nearly picked up the Senate, because Americans like divided government and people are worried about President Trump's choices. But the second thing that you see in American politics is that, so the Chicago Council on Global Affairs does these annual polls of American public attitudes, and they have recorded the biggest swings since they have been taking these polls of public attitudes, the biggest swings in the last 2 years against the president on immigration, on alliances, and on trade. So what the president, my theory of the case is that what the president's genuinely brilliant at is saying, why don't allies do more? Aren't immigrants taking our jobs? And isn't trade making us putting our jobs at risk? And if people like me were better at our jobs, we could have answered those questions to people's satisfaction, but we didn't, and we certainly didn't fast enough. But I think what you see happening is the great democratic advantage, which is people being forced to think their way through a problem and coming to a reasonable answer.
Hi, Corey. I'm Frances Adamson, Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, and I think you know Richard Maud, my colleague who's hoping to, Deputy Secretary, who's hoping to join you a bit later. First thing is, I think we can both reasonably expect to live to 2030 and probably to 2040, and I'll bet you that DFAT white paper GDP figures, they were not done on 10% projections, and in fact we are very well aware, obviously, of the slowing of China's economy. So, I mean, it is a fair enough debating point, and I wouldn't normally have called you out on it, but we're reasonably confident about it, not that we would necessarily want to draw the conclusions that everyone simply draws, looking at the relative sizes of it. I'm an optimist too. I've never thought about a tiara actually, but that might be a good idea. Martin Parkinson's here. Do you think I could have one to wear to the Secretary's Committee on National Security? But look, I have to say, having served in China and arrived there only 3 days before Gary Locke, your ambassador you referred to, who was the one who made that very powerful impact on air quality. You know, I think the inherent brittleness of authoritarian regimes is absolutely there. We can't tell when it's going to become more obvious, but I think the contrast you draw between, or the similarity actually, between China and the Soviet Union falls away a bit given the earnestness with which the Chinese have over the last 40 years wanted to learn the lessons from every failure everywhere in the world, including when it comes to the middle income trap. I think they've got a bit of a longer way to go when it comes to the dividend from urbanisation, but I don't disagree fundamentally with the point that you made about that. I do, though, think, and I've had to sadly come to the opposite conclusion myself, that we, by simply saying a free society cannot generate innovation, and I know you didn't put it quite as starkly as that, but I think we've seen amazing strides by the Chinese, including when it comes to sort of becoming almost a cashless society. And a lot of their innovation, of course, has been built on stolen intellectual property, but they are where they are, and I think they are able to generate those, that sort of growth. Your comment about the social credit system, I think, is right. There are a whole range of things that are being stored up as problems. I thoroughly enjoyed reading your book, and of course you always agree. I think you enjoy reading books more when you agree with almost everything in them. And I live next door to Rory Metcalfe, so the fact that he's noticed what we're doing is good. I think I could have given you a much longer list of Australian examples to fit your thesis. My question, though, there's got to be a question. Can the liberal world order be preserved? To my mind, the question is not really about preservation, but it's about can it adapt in order to continue to thrive, and what do we need to do to make that happen? Now, we've been giving it quite a lot of thought, but you have too, and I'd be very interested to know what you think about that.
I will be happy to answer that, but before you give away the microphone, may I ask you a question? What is your... So I think one of the challenges for China is fostering and keeping talent. What is your theory of the case of Jack Ma? What is going on there? Why does he leave the field of running Alibaba? Should we understand that as, you know, a rich guy who wants to go to Aspen and talk about saving the world the way every American CEO does? Or should we see pernicious government action in that?
Well, I mean, I knew Jack Ma when I was there, when I was in China. I knew quite a lot of people in China who are no longer doing what they were doing then. And some of them were party secretaries or provincial governors or mayors of towns, and many of them have been caught up in the anti-corruption drive. Whether that's really all there was, I'm not sure. But increasingly, I have come to the view, and I've worked on China on and off for the last 30-plus years, I've increasingly come to the view that the pernicious view is not a bad place to start in thinking about these things.
Thank you. I appreciate that education. So your point about...
preservation versus adaptation.
Adapting the liberal order. I'm all in favor of it, because as I said, liberal societies aren't good at having it right, we're good at getting it right, and experimenting and fine-tuning. But I think also I'd be interested in folks' views on whether you see adaptation on China's part. We're doing a big study at the IISS on the Belt and Road Initiative, and we're tracking three different trajectories. The first trajectory is if it works as advertised, right? They provide loans that Bretton Woods institutions wouldn't provide for the development of infrastructure in countries that reshape the trading map and advantageously position China in value chains of the global economy, right? That's what they say, and that's one potential trajectory. The second potential trajectory is the debt trap diplomacy, that it's a gigantic debt for equity swap, and they are going to end up repossessing infrastructure that then has enormous security implications for all of the rest of us. The third trajectory is the one I actually find most interesting, and I think we begin to see signs of it. So since you're a serious China hand, I'd love to hear your thoughts on whether you think it's plausible that China, having experienced setbacks, right, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Maldives, Malaysia, even Pakistan beginning to reconsider the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor projects. Whether the Chinese see those setbacks and adapt in a way that leads to the success of the program, and what those adaptations would require, in my judgment, is actually China becoming a responsible stakeholder in the international order. And let me offer two data points that make me, again, my tiara, make me slightly hopeful. The first is that I'm not sure whether the Chinese begin to run out of money or whether they are just looking for partners, but they have approached sovereign wealth funds in the Gulf and also Norway about jointly doing the investments. Which gives us levers to make the loans transparent, to make the loans sustainable, to make sure that they don't get repossession rights. And then the second possibility, the second potential lever I think I see, is the Chinese reaching out to Japanese construction firms in order to improve the quality of the infrastructure that they're building. Which again leaves us huge opportunities, and I think the Japanese have been taking very adroitly in their competitor to the BRI that they and the Indians are building together, and in thinking about ways to force transparency and standards into the process of infrastructure. So afterwards, I won't put you on the spot now, but I'd love to know your views on that.
We have time for one more. Why don't we go right at the back?
Thank you for that insightful speech. Simon is my name. I'm a director of the Australian Risk Policy Institute. I've read a lot about China over the years. I've been there many, many times. Perhaps the threat or challenge that we should be viewing shouldn't be one of a rising China, but perhaps one of a collapsing China. At the beginning of the great novel, The Romance of the Three Kingdoms, it starts with an epigrammatic statement. Out of unity, there will come unity, and out of unity, there will come disunity. If you look at China's history over the last 150 years, or even the last 1,000 years, periods of time in which one Chinese ruler ruled over even more than half of what you would call China proper are not the norm. Perhaps the greatest challenge we have is the one of where China collapses under its own weight and its contradictions. How would the liberal order deal with something the magnitude of which would be perhaps close to 50 to 100 times greater than the Syrian crisis that we have? This is not an out-of-field observation, but one which the Chinese themselves, and if you look at their billionaires, are worried about at the moment. They're all moving their money. So how do you think the liberal order should deal with that, perhaps that challenge?
Wow, that's a fabulous question. So Dan Dresner wrote a terrific book about, what was it called? The System Worked. And it was about the way international institutions responded to the financial crisis in 2008 and the informal coordination between central banks to keep windows of credit open, and the buffering role of the IMF, and the other Bretton Woods institutions. And so I thought it was a terrific book, and it shaped a lot of how I think about this issue. My guess is that an economic collapse in China would have such enormous repercussions across everybody else's economy that there would likely be a rush from institutions and from central bankers and from treasuries to try and put a safety net and buffer the collapse, even at a time where we think about a rising China as a challenger and as an adversary. Because what central banks and treasuries do is try and protect the economies. So I think that's the first thing. I think you would see the rush to help. But the argument against that is, is we didn't help the Russians, right? One of the things Russians always say really angrily is that, how is it you guys would bail out Mexico and you would let Russia default? And the honest answer is our economy is so intertwined with Mexico's economy that we didn't want the political and economic consequences of Mexican failure. And we were sufficiently insulated from a Russian failure that we didn't have to care. I think we would all have to care if there were a precipitous collapse of the Chinese economy. If it's a slow bleed and the consequence of policies, the anti-corruption campaign driving everybody out of the country and the way it's driving their money out of the country right now, if it's a slow bleed, I'm thinking of Castiglione's Book of the Courtier, written in Renaissance Florence, where he says that if your enemy's standing in water up to their waist, offer a generous hand to help them out, and if they're in water up to their neck, step on their head. And if the Chinese have a slow corrosion, we can afford to step on their head, but a precipitous collapse, we would probably have to help them out of the water, would be my guess. China's behavior is activating the antibodies against it. You know, that your government and mine didn't wake up one morning and think, wow, we don't have anything to do with our militaries these days. Let's manage a rising China. It was China's behavior that sparked all of our alarm as Australia, like you guys are the front lines of this fight. So I think there will be a tendency to want China to reap its just rewards for stealing intellectual property, for building back doors into telecommunications systems. But if it happens fast, we're going to have to do something about it for the preservation of our own economies. Thank you. I'd never actually thought about that problem before. I appreciate you giving it. I will give it a lot of thought to try and come up with a better answer for myself.
I thought it was a great answer. In fact, they all were. So we're out of time. Would you please thank Corey Sharkey?
Thank you, guys, for coming to have this conversation.
I have only one remaining duty, which is actually some exciting news. Around what I'd like to ask you to do around the middle of the year is to look out for the next volume in this series, which is by our own Lowy Institute senior fellow, Richard McGregor, who you will know as a senior journalist with the Financial Times, who was in China. And you'll also know him as the author of an acclaimed book on the Chinese Communist Party called The Party. I can give you just a little hint of what's going to be in it by telling you that the title of this book is Xi Jinping, The Backlash. So please look out for that in the middle of the year. But in the meantime, please buy this one when you go outside. And I'm sure Corey will be happy to sign a copy for you.
She will.
Thank you all for coming.